Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. According to recent statistics, the number of Americans dealing with anxiety disorders is over 40 million, and that number is increasing. My guest today is one of those Americans who suffered from bouts of anxiety all of his life. He's also a successful journalist, so he decided to use his journalistic chops to explore the history of anxiety and how we treat it in the hopes he could gain more insight about the mental disorder that has plagued him since his youth. His name is Scott Stossel. He's an editor at The Atlantic and the author of My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. We begin our conversation discussing Scott's experience with anxiety that began as a child, what anxiety feels like, and how he's treated it throughout his life. We then dig into the history of anxiety, looking at how it's been viewed differently through time, and at what point psychologists classified it as a mental disorder. Scott then walks us through the different theories about what causes anxiety and what the research says about the best ways to treat it. And we end our conversation discussing the state of Scott's anxiety today and whether he thinks he'll ever be cured. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/ageofanxiety. Scott joins me now via clearcast.io. All right, Scott Stossel, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you wrote a book, My Age of Anxiety, which is a cultural history, a scientific history of anxiety, which is something that a lot more Americans are struggling with, they are reporting struggling with. But not only is this a history, it's a narrative of your own struggle with anxiety throughout your life. So let's start there. How long have you been struggling and dealing with anxiety?
It's honestly been pretty much a lifelong struggle from a very young age. I mean, the earliest I can remember, you know, I had terrible acute separation anxiety when I was a little kid. You know, anytime I was away from my parents, I was convinced that they were dead or had died in a car crash or that they were, you know, actually robots and had, I was part of some experiment. And, you know, and then by the time I got to school, I would have anxious stomach aches and anxious headaches, and I'd always end up in the nurse's office. I would worry incessantly about all kinds of things. So really from the time I was, my earliest memories, I remember being worried about things. So I think a temperamental tendency towards anxiety and worry that manifested itself at a very, very young age.
And did it manifest itself differently as you know, over the years, as you got older?
Yeah. I mean, the separation anxiety, and that's sort of a classic early manifestation of people who grow up to develop, you know, what's clinically called anxiety disorders. But over time, you know, I sort of developed specific phobias, you know, fear of heights, fear of enclosed spaces, fear of cheese and fear of vomiting, fear of flying, which was a pretty acute one that still plagues me today. I also, as I got older, started developing, sort of having panic attacks, which, you know, anyone who's experienced them knows are awful. And when they recur with any frequency over a period of time, you know, that becomes clinically known as panic disorder. So I had that. And then when I got to, you know, middle school and high school, I had all kinds of social anxiety where I'd worry about interacting with other people, particularly, you know, performing in public. I would, you know, I was in the school play in sixth grade and it was humiliating. I had to walk off stage because I lost the ability to speak. And so, and then I carried all that with me, you know, into adulthood. You know, basically these anxieties were unfortunately additive, not substituting. You know, I wasn't like switching one for the other. It's just every time I got a new anxiety, I would just add that to the ones I already had. And so by the time I got to, you know, high school and then young adulthood, I was not all the time, but pretty constantly struggling with some collection of fears about going to school, traveling, getting sick, dealing with other people. And, you know, having the strain of dealing with that would lead to depression. So it was a pretty toxic stew of negative emotions I was dealing with by the time I was a young adult.
Right. 1-2 punch. And I imagine, I mean, you're still, I mean, we'll talk about it. You're still working with this stuff today, but like you're a public, you're a writer for, you know, The Atlantic. I mean, you're a public figure. I mean, is it still something you struggle with? And then, like, the fact that you have to do speaking engagements or things like that, is that something you have to manage as well?
It is. And, you know, I'm what they call, you know, I'm a high functioning person with anxiety disorder. I mean, there's some people who get so anxious that they, you know, they're what's called agoraphobia, where their, you know, their panic disorder gets so bad that, you know, the range of things they can do gets smaller and smaller. And eventually there are people who are, you know, confined to their houses or even confined to one room in their house and can't do anything for years at a time. And I've had periods like that, fortunately short periods, where I could feel the world sort of closing in on me. But for the most part, with a combination of medication, other kinds of therapy, and just, you know, sort of force of will, sometimes have managed to, you know, mostly manage to, you know, live a normal life and have a career, you know, and there are ways in which, and I talk about this in the book, in which, you know, anxiety has its benefits, or at least it's connected to temperamental traits that are good. So if you're super anxious about things, you know, you're kind of hyper vigilant, which makes you, you know, good at scanning the environment and being aware of your social situation and sort of being able to read social cues. I mean, people with social anxiety probably overread them, but it can be a useful skill. You know, preparing, worrying a lot can be debilitating if it's excessive, but it also helps you to plan for different eventualities. You can kind of look ahead. You know, I think that just the struggles I've had with my mental health have made me more empathetic towards other people who have those struggles, and even to people who don't have those struggles. So I think it helps with communication. So there are a lot of ways in which, even though I hate my anxiety when it's, you know, flaring up, it's probably propelled me along. And it makes me conscientious because I'm afraid of screwing up. I'm afraid of looking bad. And that becomes kind of a motivator. So, you know, a lot of times I feel like I'm kind of patched together or barely holding it together because my anxiety is so bad, or, you know, I'm sort of pharmaceutically armored against my anxiety. And that's how I've struggled through. But yeah, and I still struggle with it today a lot. And we can talk about that more later if you want. But I've been fortunate enough to manage to, you know, mostly be a productive member of society.
Well, this book came out 2014. So it's been 5 years. You're seeing all these reports come out, you know, week after week about how Americans, particularly young Americans and, you know, young Westerners, right, in general, are increasingly feeling like they're anxious or they're suffering from anxiety. What are the numbers? Like, how many Americans do we know, like, are reporting being anxious?
They're really high. And there was a study it was before my book came out, but some years ago, that talked about how, you know, the average level of anxiety for a typical high school student now, self-rated report of anxiety, is the same as it was for inpatient, you know, psychiatric patients in the 1950s. So basically, you know, the average kid today is as anxious and neurotic and miserable as people who were in, you know, in psychiatric hospitals a couple generations ago. And then there's all kinds of other, you know, statistics that just show levels of stress, worry, anxiety disorder diagnoses, you know, are much, much higher in young people, you know, pretty much across all Western countries. You know, particularly there's a lot of data about Europe and the United States. In the U.S., I think, I mean, there's so much data that you know, suggests that this is something real. I think part of it is our definitions of what constitutes, you know, a clinical anxiety disorder have expanded and become a little bit more elastic, partly because we know more about these disorders and so people now can identify them, partly because you've got now drugs that have been approved to treat them. So you've got kind of the marketing imperatives of the drug companies, you know, the broader you can more broadly you can define an anxiety disorder, the more people you have that you're able to prescribe it to. So partly this is inflation of a diagnostic category. I think in any society, there's a, you know, some complement of people who will be anxious, you know, under many circumstances. But I also think that there are a lot of factors about the culture and the society right now that are driving people, and particularly young people, to be more anxious. And, you know, at the largest kind of societal level, it's, you know, we're in a long period, really going all the way back to the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, but, you know, accelerating now in the internet age, of just, you know, rapid change, economic dislocation, all kinds of transitions. There's just a lot, you know, the pace of life because of the internet, the way people, you know, select themselves into tribes, the pressure to create your own personal brand on the internet. There's just so many sort of countervailing pressures that confuse young people about what their identity is. And, you know, in centuries past, you're kind of born into your role. Your family had a status in the tribe or in the medieval village you lived in, or even, you know, in your, you know, farm village in the 19th century America. Now, you know, who are you? You know, you can choose your gender, you can choose your sexual preference, you can choose the groups you affiliate with socially. And all of this creates a lot of stress. And then the last factor I would say is just, there's been a lot written about this, you know, particularly people in the millennial generation and younger, there's so much, you know, helicopter parenting, and your parents are super involved and, you know, driven in trying to make their kids succeed. But the combination of like overprotectiveness and trying to, you know, and pressure to achieve is really toxic, because on the one hand, these kids feel all this pressure to succeed and do better than their parents and get into good colleges or do whatever. And at the same time, the parents are doing things for them that parents of previous generations wouldn't. It sort of robs them of their feeling of autonomy and resilience. And it's really sort of an epidemic thing. And I've talked to a lot of psychiatrists, you know, both for the book, but then also just, you know, people I've come to know who are now friends who are psychiatrists or therapists, and they see this as just kind of an epidemic phenomenon. So all those factors kind of combine to create soaring levels of anxiety.
So let's talk. You mentioned, you know, there's sort of a cultural component to anxiety. It's not that like it's a, you know, anxiety is a cultural construct, right? Like it exists. It's biology, rooted in biology, but like the culture has an influence. You know, for example, you know, the diagnostic of anxiety disorder didn't exist 35 years ago. Like I'm older than that, right? I'm 37, 30. How old am I? 36. I forgot how old. Some point you stop counting how old you are.
That's right. Yeah, it becomes a defense mechanism.
Right. But that doesn't mean that people weren't anxious. So like, what did we call anxiety, like say like 2000 years ago or 100 years ago or even 50 years ago?
Yeah, no, good question. And it's been called all different things. I mean, obviously the emotion that we feel, or the set of emotional and physical experiences you have in your body when you are feeling what we now call anxiety, you know, humans have experienced since there were humans. You know, what did they call it before there were, you know, in pre-literate times when they were cavemen? You know, they didn't have a concept of anxiety, but when they went out of the cave and they were worried about getting eaten by a saber-toothed tiger, you know, their palms would sweat, their hair would stand on end, their stomachs would hurt. Like that is anxiety. Even in animals, you know, the fight or flight response is a sort of evolutionary, you know, programmed instinct to help keep species alive. So what we call anxiety today sort of, you know, emanates from that deeply rooted evolutionary biological reality. But over the years, you know, different cultures have, and, you know, science has called it all kinds of different things. So, you know, for many years, you know, in the Renaissance, they would group anxiety, what we now call anxiety and depression, together under, you know, melancholy. If you suffered from what, you know, you were worried about things, or had depressed, you were called melancholy. You know, once you get into the 19th century in Europe and America, they would call it asthenia, and it was meant to describe, this described a kind of set of traits that was a combination of physical things, and it could be like dizziness, sweats, you know, gastrointestinal problems, and emotional things, you know, phobias, worry, and basically could encompass anything, because, you know, your anxiety is, you experience it in your brain, but it has effect throughout your body. So neurasthenia is what they call it. You know, getting into the Freudian age, you know, Freud became very influential through the 20th century, particularly into the mid 20th century. And, you know, he talked about what we today call anxiety as neurosis. And it really, that was just sort of he had a different theory of what caused it, you know, childhood sexual, you know, repressed sexual desire, conflicts with your parents, the Oedipal complex, which has sort of been debunked now. But as a kind of cultural idiom, the idea of neuroses became very prominent in the culture. So that was kind of through, you know, World War II up until really until 1980, when the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the Bible of the psychiatric profession, they redefined the neuroses as anxiety. So technically, you know, anxiety disorders didn't exist when you were born, and they didn't exist when I was a little kid. I'm 49 now. So, you know, for the first 10 years of my life, and I was starting to get taken to psychiatrists, they would say I have, you know, childhood, you know, neurosis or something like that. It's now been redefined as anxiety. So the labels we put on this do kind of inflect how we think about them and how we treat them, but it is the same underlying set of, you know, you and I, or I speaking for myself, I would be feeling the same set of unpleasant thoughts, emotions, and physical sensations, whatever age I was in and whatever we choose to call it, which is now we classify them as anxiety disorders.
Right. And the way we describe it and the way we talk about it has changed. Like, for example, in the Renaissance, melancholia, like, yeah, you were sort of depressed and anxious, but like, it was sort of romantic too, right? Like, it was like, well, you're this like ponderous romantic person who's thinking about big thoughts. And so it was actually there was like a positive spin on it, but then like Freud kind of saying, no, neurosis is bad. We got to, you know, solve your neurosis by sitting on a couch and talking to a therapist over and over again until you solve it. So there's that sort of swinging back and forth between, yeah, there's some good and bad, but then like, oh, it's all bad.
Yeah. And there's often been, like you referenced the Renaissance era, you know, this sense that, you know, having melancholy is attached to having an artistic or refined or sophisticated sensibility. And it was actually seen to be sort of a desirable trait. You know, if you were melancholic, it meant you were creative and artistic and must be very smart. And sometimes that, you know, they're this is contested, you know, among actual experts about whether is there a link between mental illness of various kinds, including anxiety and depression, and creativity. You know, so many famous writers, for instance, and artists have had, you know, very prominent psychiatric disorders or alcoholism or things like that. You know, is there an alliance between the things that make you anxious and depressed and the things that give you a kind of artistic sensibility? Maybe there's, like I say, different people dispute that. And you're right that the sort of cultural interpretation we put on anxiety changes. And, you know, one thing in particular, you know, as a man, you know, that this has been changing recently, but there's a lot of shame associated with, you know, is anxiety cowardice, you know, and cowardice is shameful. You know, there's almost no worse epithet you can sling at a man than being a coward or whatever. And yet, But suppressing this stuff or not treating it can be very dangerous. And so, you know, instead of going to a therapist, a lot of people turn to alcohol or drugs and basically try to manage their anxiety in very unhealthy ways that can be quite dangerous.
And we'll get into that a little bit more because I'd like to talk about stuff like Navy SEALs and neuropeptide wide and whatever. But you know, so talking about the current diagnosis of anxiety, what I thought was interesting, you explore the DSM and how they kind of came up with it. And we've talked about some other people when we talked about depression, how a lot of this stuff, it's sort of like ad hoc. Like there was like this kind of threw spaghetti at the wall, or sometimes there's like dinners and they're like, well, here are the five things that we think that you can use to diagnose anxiety. Like it often seems very arbitrary sometimes.
It's often completely arbitrary. I mean, I was fascinated when doing research for this book and hearing some of these people talk. Like, so the people who did the last edition, a previous edition of the DSM, you know, every, you know, 10 or 20, 30 years, they reissue a new one. And they were, when they introduced all the anxiety disorders for the first time, that was in 1980 with the DSM-3, the third edition. And yeah, that, you know, I would hear people who are part of the committee that came up with the categories. And yeah, they'd be like sitting around and they would have come up with, you know, a definition for like panic disorder. But even that was arbitrary. They'd say, well, if you have, you know, it's if you have six, I'm trying to remember, if you have, you know, X number of panic attacks over a period of 6 months, well, then you have panic disorder. Well, why did they choose 6 months, like, instead of, you know, a year or 2 months? And why X number of panic attacks instead of Y? And the more interesting one was then they were talking about, well, we've got all these different kinds of anxieties categorized into discrete disorders. So you've got, you know, phobias, which is, you know, fear of specific things. You've got social anxiety, which is fear of social situations. We've got panic disorder, which is panic attacks. You've got OCD, which is obsessive compulsive disorder. But then what about, so they're at this dinner and they're like, well, what about our colleague, you know, Joe? He's just sort of generally anxious. And they're like, oh, well, let's come up with something called generalized anxiety disorder. And so they wrote that into the third edition of the DSM. And then once it exists as a real category, then researchers and drug companies start to treat it as a real thing. And they, you know, do studies based on the sets of symptoms that you're supposed to have to be characterized with that disease. And it starts to become sort of reified into, you know, like, well, you're testing for a thing that you made up in the first place. And again, it's not that the underlying suffering's not real and not there, but is generalized anxiety disorder really its own separate disorder? Or is it, as some people now think, just a subset of depression, you know, or depression with anxiety? You know, people who are depressed often worry a lot and get sort of sucked up into their own head. Well, that's what people with generalized anxiety disorder do. They just worry incessantly and kind of spin in circles in their head. Being very anxious can be depressing. So, you know, no wonder that anxiety and depression are so often, you know, co-occur in people. And then many people with depression experience anxiety. So it's unclear how these things really, you know, in the DSM, they're very neatly cleaved from one another. So, you know, this disorder is distinct from that disorder. A lot of people are now starting to think maybe, especially as they start to look at the neuroscience of this, which is still in early stages, but maybe this is all kind of variants of the same thing. I imagine like 100 years from now, when scientists look back, they may think that our categorizations of these things are pretty crude, but they're the best we have right now.
Right. Like when we think about how people talk about neurasthenia,
right? Well, that was kind of silly.
Or hysteria, was a sort of, particularly for women. But there was some, what was that? Was that a cultural phenomenon? Was it a medical phenomenon? It was kind of both. And these things always intersect. And that's always interesting to me. Like when you have a real, biological thing that gets interpreted culturally, that's fascinating and really does change how we treat and think about people who have these disorders.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's INDOCHINO.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Spring is here and the McKays are going to be really busy. I'm coaching flag football again. My daughter's playing basketball. And on those nights when we don't have time to cook a full meal and clean up, we like to eat Factor meals. Factor meals are ready-to-eat meals that are on the table in less than 2 minutes. They're fresh, they're not frozen, they're chef-crafted and dietitian-approved. You eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. You just simply heat and savor the good stuff. And all these meals are really, really nutritious. They're macro-friendly if you're tracking your macros. That's another reason why I like them. So we've been using Factor Meals for a while. One thing I've enjoyed lately is the green chili chicken. Super tasty. I also like the creamy mushroom chicken and rice. Very good. It also comes with garlic green beans. And again, you just warm these things up in 2 minutes, and then you have this really delicious meal. And best of all, clean up's a breeze. If you want to try this out, head to factormeals.com/manliness50 and use code manliness50, that's manliness50, to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's a good deal. That's code manliness50, manliness50 at factormeals.com/manliness50. Get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, MANLINESS. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn the art of negotiation from Chris Voss. We had him on the podcast. Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest. Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the Masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this Masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss. And now back to the show.
And I imagine it can cause a lot of confusion and frustration for people struggling with it. They're going to help and they're getting inconsistent diagnoses from different, like, because, like, you know, one therapist will be like, well, you have this, but not this. So you're this. And it's like, well, what am I? Like, what am I supposed to be doing with what I, how am I supposed to go after what I have?
Yeah. After my book came out, I had a lot of people say that, or, you know, versions of that, that they, you know, struggled a lot. But in general, I will say, you know, most therapists, that there's a lot of agreement, and it may change, but, you know, there are certain things that there's emerging data about what works for kind of all these things or many of these things. So, for instance, there's a form of therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy, which is basically a combination, you know, helping people to change, you know, change their thoughts to make them, you know, less maladaptive, you know, break the cycle of negative thinking and sort of reality test in a better way. You know, people are worried about things who have, you know, generalized anxiety disorder, they always see the worst case scenario. And cognitive behavioral therapy helps you restructure your way of thinking so you can see things in a more realistic way, and then help you change your behavior and exposing yourself to the things, you know, if you have anxiety, exposing yourself to the things you're afraid of to kind of decondition you from the fear. There's a lot of evidence over now, you know, more than a decade, that that kind of therapy can work for all kinds of anxiety disorder, for obsessive compulsive disorder, for depression. So there are things that work. And then there are certain medications. I mean, medication is, you know, we may talk about that. That's a whole complex stew where my sense is, you know, medications can work, but there is a great mystery about how they work, when they work, who they work for, what the downsides are. But there are some studies and a lot of evidence that suggests that for some people, certain medications can help them with their anxiety, their depression. So even though we're still kind of groping around for, you know, proper definitions and everything is kind of, these categorizations are messy, there are things that are generally believed to work.
And we'll talk about medications. That's interesting as well. Because that's, again, it's like the coming with the how we define and diagnose anxiety. A lot of the medication developed were very ad hoc, and we'll talk about it because it's really interesting as well. But let's talk about, like, what causes anxiety? Because, like, some people will look at it, well, it's just like a choice. Like, it's like you can just snap out of it. Like, you know, get yourself together. But there's also evidence that says, no, there's a genetic component to it. Well, so what's going on what causes anxiety?
There are multiple causes, but there is a very strong, you know, there's tons of evidence that there is a strong genetic component. You know, and just about everybody has some adaptive predisposition to experience, you know, have a fight or flight response, to have a fear response. But there are some people who, because of their genes, are born with, you know, what psychologists call a temperament that is more highly reactive. And so it's literally, you know, the genes in their, you know, their DNA encodes for a physiology that is more high reactive. And so those people, you know, just, and you can detect it in babies, you know, you can often tell the ones that are going to grow up to have, you know, anxiety disorders because they have more exaggerated what's called startle responses. You know, if you make a loud noise or flash a light at them, you know, you can see their heart rate increases more, they sweat more, they have, you know, electric conductance in their skin is greater. So it literally is, at some level, you can't control it. It's deeply, deeply wired in. And, you know, scientists are starting to look at the various, you know, clusters of genes that lead to that. So some people are just born with a ready predisposition to be anxious. But then on top of that, there's kind of the environmental factor. And there's also tons of evidence that, you know, and this is where Freud wasn't wrong, you know, early childhood experiences have a profound impact on your psychology and your sort of mental resilience, psychological resilience for the rest of your life. So people, kids and adults who are exposed to trauma, you know, it changes your brain chemistry and even your brain structure in such a way that, you know, this is what PTSD is. You're now much more prone to anxiety and depression, you know, panic attacks. So, you know, it's a gene environment interaction. And there are some people who are born with such an anxious predisposition that even small stressors are going to send them into spiraling anxiety or depression and make them develop a disorder. There are other people who are going to be much more resistant to it. But, you know, even those people, most of them, many of them anyway, if exposed to enough trauma, you know, war or, you know, something horrific in childhood, will develop the elements of an anxiety disorder. And then overlaid on top of that, as we were talking about earlier, they're kind of the cultural and social level stuff. You know, are there certain cultures or periods of history that are more anxiety causing than others? And I think the evidence suggests that there are. But I think the strongest contributor by far is your genes. You know, there are some people who are just have the misfortune to be born highly anxious, and some people who are born sort of more serene. But, you know, as with all human traits, then environment plays a role too. So,
yeah. Well, you talk about even in your own family, anxiety seems to run in your family.
Yeah. So, you know, when I was both in my therapy, but as I was researching the book, you know, I was trying to figure out, well, what is the source of my own anxiety? And, you know, my mom, you know, super high worrier, had a lot of phobias, which I got from her, you know, and did I get them from her by watching her? Did I learn them from her, sort of from environmental, or is it, you know, genetically encoded? And then her, you know, parents, you know, both had kind of elements of, you know, had worrying personality traits. Her grandfather, my great grandfather, you know, had struggled terribly with what they then called anxiety neurosis and was institutionalized in psychiatric hospitals, you know, many times. Again, he had a very successful career, was a smart, accomplished guy, but then would just get completely incapacitated by his anxiety, would have to go to the mental hospital and get electroshock therapy to kind of get his brain reset. And then, you know, I've got other relatives who struggle with this. So, and then studies show that once you have, you know, some number of anxious people in a family, it just, you'll find many, many more. And, you know, is that transmitted by environment? You know, did I learn it from my mom, from watching my mom, from watching my grandparents? Maybe. Or was it transmitted through my genes? Well, probably that too. And you can never, you know, completely disentangle them.
Well, yeah, going back to that idea that you brought up that, you know, for men, anxiety can be like a slap in the face because, like, if you have it, like, you're a coward. But, like, you know, we were talking about Navy SEALs. Like, some people are born with a predisposition to be very anxious, but some are born with just, like, they're just water off a duck's back, right? Like, Navy SEALs, they've done research on them where they found, like, they actually have a genetic predisposition to be hyper-resilient even in super stressful situations.
Exactly. I was fascinated by that study. So, I mean, Navy SEALs are really interesting to study because they're such extreme, like, human specimens, you know, and to get to the point where you get through Navy SEAL training, it's like you must be a, you know, incredibly physically fit. And then they put you through these physical hardships like sleep deprivation and, you know, incredible hardship. And, you know, the physical part is hard enough, but these guys, you know, they're able to withstand almost like a form of, you know, torture that would cause, you know, me or many other people to just kind of break down. And so there's a guy at Yale who was studying, you know, what is it that makes these guys so resilient? And he was actually looking, you know, he would take, I think it was from their blood samples, you know, measuring different neurotransmitters in their brain. And he found that the Navy SEALs who succeeded in doing the Navy SEAL training had unusually high levels of something called neuropeptide Y. And, you know, basically if you have a high level of, and they could actually predict in advance to try to determine cause and effect, like, is it, you know, finishing the course that, like, gives you a boost of confidence or something that causes your neuropeptide Y to rise, or do you have kind of a natural baseline level of it? When they looked at these people in advance, they could almost predict how they would do on the test by their levels of a neuropeptide Y in advance. And there are other studies that show that neuropeptide Y, you know, your levels of that are kind of genetically determined, or at least partly genetically determined, which, you know, to me is powerful evidence that your level of psychological resilience is, you know, conferred by your genes, which, you know, allows you to produce this neurotransmitter that makes you unusually psychologically resilient. But what psychologists now are really interested in studying, and in the military too, is, you know, how can you cultivate this in non-genetic ways? You know, many of us would benefit from being more resilient. So are there things that we can do through therapy or through life experiences that boost our levels of neuropeptide Y, or that create the kind of psychological structures in our head that are associated with neuropeptide Y and that make us resilient and resistant to anxiety, traumatic stress, that kind of thing? And it's a really promising area of research. You know, it's basically focusing on the people who are the least anxious and figuring out how can we use what they have going for them, both in terms of how they think and what's in their brain, to treat people who, you know, are particularly non-resilient or highly anxious.
Well, let's talk about sort of the history of treating anxiety. So you mentioned earlier, right now, there's a lot of promising research and, you know, studies have shown that cognitive behavior therapy can help mitigate or help people manage their anxiety. But besides that, what are some of the other ways, as far as therapy goes, and we've used to try to treat anxiety disorders?
Well, so these days there's cognitive behavioral therapy. There's more traditional talk therapy. I mean, CBT is kind of a form of talk therapy, but, you know, more what you think of from the movies, which is, you know, just talking to a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a social worker or a therapist of some other kind, you know, psychodynamic therapy, that's called. And there's a lot of evidence that just, you know, talking to someone who listens sympathetically to your problems, has some training in, you know, both helping you solve basic life challenges, but also, you know, helping you resolve childhood issues. There's some evidence that works. And then there's medication. And, going back really millennia. I mean, if you read, the ancient Greeks or, even Hippocrates, their sort of original, most famous doctor in history, talks about, how wine can treat anxiety. And, for years, people have been using alcohol and opium and things like that to medicate anxiety. But, just going back 100 and some years, there have been sort of waves of different things that have been used to treat, particular anxiety and then anxiety and depression. Way back at the turn of the 20th century, you had kind of barbiturates and other sedatives that were used to treat anxiety. Then around mid-century, you had the dawn of what are called the benzodiazepines. So that's Valium and Librium. And these days you have Klonopin, Xanax, Ativan, even Ambien that work on your, a set of neurotransmitters in your brain called GABA that basically calms your brain down. And that can be very effective in treating anxiety, but very dangerous too in terms of its addictive potential and, the tendency to form, habit and dependency. For depression, there have been different waves of drugs. There was the, wave of what they call the tricyclic antidepressants. Tricyclic just describes the structure of the molecule that, these were things like imipramine, desipramine. And then in the 80s, you had the first, what's called the SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And the first one and most famous one is Prozac. But these days you've got Prozac and Paxil and Zoloft and Celexa and Lexapro and a whole bunch of others in that category and related ones too that affect serotonin and norepinephrine. And basically all these drugs work on different sets of neurotransmitters to kind of, augment their levels in the brain in ways that we still don't fully understand how they work, but seem to have some efficacy in reducing anxiety and reducing depression. And I've taken a lot of these drugs myself, and some of them seem to work and some of them don't. Some of them have terrible side effects. The depressing thing about a lot of this is that, a lot of treatment just doesn't work. It takes a lot of trial and error. Therapy can be effective. And I would encourage anyone who's suffering with these things to, seek out treatment because it can be a lifesaver. But it can sometimes takes a few tries to find a therapist that you like or a medication that works. And if you look at the long-term evidence, really it's like a third to a half or something of any treatment works. And it's not always clear why the thing that's working is working. And that's why CBT is probably the best evidence, has the best evidence in its favor. And it also has in its favor since it's not a drug. It's not addictive. It's not dependency forming. It doesn't, and ideally you can kind of learn the skills from CBT and take them with you through your life, and keep practicing them. Unlike, if you're on a drug and it works, what happens if you go off the drug? Sometimes you can have, withdrawal issues. So
yeah, it's a lot. I think you brought up an interesting point that anxiety sounds like it's something that you can't really, you're never going to be cured of it, right? Like you're always going to have to just manage it for most of your life.
I would love to be able to be cured of it. And I still, some of the time with, 10% of my brain hope that I could be, to achieve like complete serenity. And not that there won't be things that scare me or that I don't, worry about legitimately, but it's not something that plagues me. And I think, some people, they get really, the one thing I didn't mention is mindfulness practice. These days, there's tons of evidence that various meditation skills and practices and other forms of mindfulness really can help confer the kind of resiliency and calm that say neuropeptide Y does in these Navy SEALs. And so I, in my therapy, I've tried a combination of CBT with trying to do meditation stuff. So I think it is, and you're not cured. You're always going to have your underlying genetics. So if you're a high reactive person, someone who is prone to be nervous about things, that's probably always going to be the case. But you can reduce the amount of it, and as you say, you can learn to manage it with different sets of skills from whatever kind of therapy you're using, or to manage it with medication, or to, sort of adjust your lifestyle. I mean, sometimes if you're anxious or depressed, that's your body and your brain telling you something's not right in your life and you need to, make some changes, and sometimes having a better lifestyle. And all this obvious cliched stuff that people tell you is true. It's really important to get sleep. For me, if I'm underslept, my anxiety goes through the roof. It's for me also, and tons of studies support this, regular exercise. I mean, these are basic things that don't cost anything, you don't need insurance for. But in modern life, it's sometimes hard to work out regularly. It's hard to get a good night's sleep when you've got deadlines. So all these things, if you do them all, you can actually minimize the effect that anxiety has on your life. And there's always going to be, I mean, for me, there's things that erupt that cause my anxiety to spike. But when I'm doing well, I can both have those spikes be fewer and farther between, and also when they happen, manage them better and not have them, send me spiraling off the rails or sort of over-medicating myself. So there's a long-winded way of saying, yes, you know, if one can learn to manage them, and if you can do that, then you can live a pretty, you know, fulfilling and rewarding life that's not, you know, the constant misery that anxiety can sometimes be.
Right. I think that's hopeful because, I mean, if there's a strong genetic component to anxiety, you know, people who have that problem, they're listening, they're like, well, crap, I'm hosed. Yeah. Like that could be the approach, or it could be like, well, okay, this is the thing. I got to work with it. It's not great, but I can manage it. There's things I can do.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember talking to my therapist when I was sort of learning about my great-grandfather and all the terrible troubles that he had, and then multiple, you know, hospitalizations. And I was like, God, you know, he reminds me so much of myself, and I have, you know, his genes and this, I'm doomed to this. And my therapist was like, first of all, he's your great-grandfather. You have like a tiny fraction of his genes. And second of all, you know, there's medications we have now that he didn't have access to that can help you. And, you know, there's just lots of stuff that you can do. You're not, yes, genetics is powerful, but you're not doomed to your genetic fate. And we can learn to cultivate resilience. And a lot of the therapies that are effective, like I say, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, but just in general, you know, facing your fears. And I'm, you know, it's easy for me to say this and sometimes hard for me to do. But the more you know, if you have specific phobias like fear of flying or fear of public speaking, the more you do it, the easier it gets. And that's sort of a, you know, simple lesson, but it's true. And it's just, you know, for me, sometimes those things can be so anxiety producing that I can't do them. And then I feel like it's a setback and my anxiety gets worse. But what my therapist always tells me is, you know, get up, persist, do it again, and you will get better. So
right. Exposure therapy. I think that's what that's
exposure therapy. Exactly. Right. Yeah. So if you have fear of heights, they'll take you up on higher and higher buildings. I mean, you know, sometimes these treatments sound kind of extreme. Like if you have severe claustrophobia, there's actually therapists who will put you in like a coffin and, you know, you have a horrible anxiety, but then you just wait it out and you realize I didn't die. You know, I'm okay. I can manage it. It was just a really unpleasant emotion. You know, for people who have flying phobia, there are pilots who will take you up. A lot of airports have programs where you can go and, you know, get walked around the plane by a pilot who explains how the whole thing works, you know, and basically little by little expose yourself, you know, sit in the plane, then go on a short plane ride, and eventually hopefully you can be flying to Europe without being completely miserable, as I've sometimes been on international flights.
And I think that's an important point for parents who might have children who are, you know, hypersensitive or super anxious. You know, oftentimes when you're a parent, you're like, well, I just don't want my kid to freak out, so I'll just avoid the thing that, you know, causes them lots of anxiety and gets them worked up. Rather, the better approach might be, well, just sort of slowly introduce that thing over and over again so they don't get scared. They're not scared of it or doesn't worry them anymore.
That's absolutely right. And I think that's really important. And what I'm about to say may sort of sound paradoxical, but it's not. You know, if you think that there's all kinds of evidence that suggests that if you think your kid might be developing, you know, unusual level of anxiety, you know, what could be a, you know, clinical level anxiety, the evidence says, you know, the earlier you can get help and get them therapy, the better outcome they'll have, the less likely they'll be to, you know, suffer anxiety disorders as an adult. So early intervention is key, but early intervention doesn't mean sparing them from anxiety. And, you know, what almost any therapist today would tell you is actually, you know, don't, and this is where, you know, it's the antidote to helicopter parenting. Don't try to do everything for your kids. Don't try to spare them the unpleasant experience or the thing that's making them nervous, you know, particularly if it's being, you know, anxious about going to school. And I know how hard that is, you know, both having been, you know, a very anxious kid and now being a parent who has anxious kids, you know, it's incredibly painful and hard to watch your child, you know, suffering and feeling nervous. And everything in my body wants to be, I just want to take him out of that situation so he's not nervous. But what, you know, their therapists, every therapist, you know, I've ever seen says, no, you have to let them, within reason, experience the anxiety and learn that they can overcome it. And that's how they develop resilience. Don't do it for them. That's how you'll helicopter your parent, your kid into being kind of a helpless, neurotic, you know, 22-year-old who can't make his own dinner.
Right. So what's the state of your anxiety today? So you've said you're doing cognitive behavioral therapy, some mindfulness meditation. Are you taking medication?
I am. So I'm still really bad at the mindfulness. And I think it's one of these catch-22s that like the people who benefit from like mindfulness and yoga and that kind of thing, meditation the most, are the ones who are worst at it. Cause you know, my thoughts are always racing. I have a hard time sitting still, but I'm trying that. Doing CBT with a really good therapist, and that's helped. Doing exposure therapy, which is really unpleasant, but I think does help. And then, yeah, I am currently on Lexapro, which is one of these SSRI medications. And then around them, I take a medication called gabapentin, which was originally a anti-seizure medication and a medication for pain, but has shown some effectiveness in treating anxiety. And then, you know, I used to take a lot of benzodiazepines. I've now try not to, they work incredibly well for me. You know, for me, that was always like my magic bullet. If I was, you know, I knew I could always survive if I could access to, you know, enough Xanax. The problem is it worked a little too well. And, you know, the danger is, I started to become too dependent on it. And, you know, the more of it you take, the more you need to take in order to get the same effect. And it can be very dangerous. People become dependent on it. So I'm trying not to use that now. And, you know, it's pretty widely prescribed by both psychiatrists and
just
family doctors, because it is so effective. But there's also, you know, a pretty big school of thought out there that's like, they really shouldn't be prescribing it so wildly because it can be, in certain people, very addictive and dependency forming.
And so I imagine it's like, and also you're doing the things like getting enough sleep, exercising, managing stress, reducing that when you can, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know why this is the case, but for me, you know, getting, you know, regular exercise it's like night and day. And my wife can even tell. You know, if at the end of the day I'm on the phone with her, she'll be like, why don't you go work out? And I'm like, well, how can you? She's like, I can just tell in your voice that you haven't. And it's like my personality changes somehow. And, you know, you don't always feel like working out. There's some people who just, you know, don't exercise at all. But for me, forcing myself to work out, even when I don't feel like it, you know, just is so good for my state of mind and good for my physical health as well. And that's true for just about everyone.
Right. Well, and I imagine if there's someone's listening to this podcast, they're struggling with anxiety, best advice, go get help, go talk to somebody. There's things you can do to help manage it. So you have a flourishing, productive life like yourself. Like you said, like, yeah, you've struggled with this your entire life, but you have a good career and you're doing a lot of great things.
Yeah. And there are a lot of ways you can get help. I mean, I'm forgetting what it stands for, but NAMI, it's like the National Alliance of Mental Health Initiative or something like that, can help you find, even if you don't have insurance, or, you know, help you find access to, you know, individual therapy or group therapy or just resources in your area. If you have anxiety in particular, there's an organization, nonprofit organization called the Anxiety and Depression Association of America. It's the ADAA. And if you go on their website, you know, they have lists of therapists in your area. And you can always just go to your primary care physician and they can help refer you. You know, if any city that has a university will often have like an anxiety disorders clinic. So there's lots of help available out there.
Well, Scott, is there some place people can go to learn more about your work?
You can go to my website. I'm embarrassed. I'm blanking on now what the...
Is it scottstossel.com?
Scottstossel.com. Yes. Thank you. I never go to it.
Right. Well, hey, Scott, this has been a great conversation. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Brad. I really appreciate it.
My guest today was Scott Stossel. He's the author of the book, My Age of Anxiety. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. You can also check out our show notes at aom.is/ageofanxiety, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM Podcast. Check out our website at artofmanliness.com, where you can see our podcast archives. We're coming up on 500 episodes here pretty soon. You can see them all there. While you're there, check out our articles we've written. We've got a couple thousand there about just about anything. Depression, how to manage that, personal finances, how to be a better husband, better father. Check it out. And if you haven't done so already, please give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It just takes 1 minute and it helps us out a lot. And if you've done that already, please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you think we get something out of it. As always, thank you for the continuous support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay reminding you not only to listen to the AOM Podcast, but put what you've heard into action.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.